Ready for the show? I'm ready to start.
10, 9, ignition sequence starts. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11. Tower clear.
Welcome to ET First Contact Radio. This is Martin Horst speaking, your host, as three times a week I do this on Sunday, Monday and Thursday. On Sunday and Monday on Finding Voices Radio, we are all connected, that's the slogan of the radio station. And Thursdays on BBS Radio, we are all connected, that's the slogan. It's very important to know that my guest today is Philip Mentel, and Philip Mentel is the former editor of the internationally distributed newsstand magazine UFO Matrix. Internationally published author, lecturer and broadcaster on the subject of UFOs. Former director of investigations of the British UFO Research Association, former MUFON representative for England, investigator of the year for the Yorkshire UFO Society and founder member of the Independent UFO Network. Also served as press officer and conference organizer of the British UFO Research Association. Books that he wrote are Once Upon a Missing Time, a novel of alien abduction that's just out, Without Consent with Carl Legates, Beyond Roswell, UFO Files of Russia, Alien Autopsy Casebook, Roswell Alien Autopsy, The Truth Behind the Film That Shocked the World, Russia's Roswell Incident with Paul Stonehill, I think, right? it's just great to have Philip on the show and to have you with us, Philip. And I think we're going to have amazing 2 hours of conversation together, of your knowledge and my knowledge combined together to make a very interesting radio program. Welcome to the show, Philip.
Good evening, Martin. Thank you very much.
Yes, it's great to have you, Philip.
So my pleasure. My pleasure. I can assure you.
Yes, the pleasure is mine. So where do we start? Do you want to talk about your new book that just came out?
Yes, Martin. I mean, you know, I've known, as you mentioned in the introduction, for some of the magazines and the non-fiction work that I've done in the past, various UFO organizations that I've previously been part of. Mm-hmm. So my latest book, Once Upon a Missing Time, is a same subject matter, Martin. It deals with alien abductions, but this time it's a work of fiction.
Right.
And although it's a work of fiction, I have used all that previous research and knowledge and experience in the UFO business, if you like, and it is based on real life accounts. You know, I have a filing cabinet here full of abduction stories of missing time, people I've interviewed face to face down the years, and I was asked why have I decided now to write a book of fiction. Well, I wrote the book some time ago. And when you talk about alien abductions, Martin, or if you write about them or you lecture mm-hmm. about them, you tend to talk about the facts.
Right.
You know, it happened on this date, it was these people, it was in this location, and this is what they saw. Rarely do you then go into the personal side of things. Mm-hmm. How did these people cope with the close encounter? To whom did they turn? Who did they speak to about it?
Yes.
How did it affect their lives and so on? And that's quite difficult when you're writing non-fiction. So I decided to put it into a work of fiction. Although, like I said, it is based on real life accounts. Most of the characters in the book are based on real people. I have just changed their name and things like that. I tried to put the close encounter witness in what I see as the right light, Martin. I think down the years they've perhaps had a bad press. You know, the skeptics will tell you they're all lunatics. Well, you and I know that's not the case.
Of course not.
So I've also pointed out as strong as I can in the book that these people are just ordinary people like you and me. They're everyday people. They have everyday difficulties, you know. It centers on a married couple, Alan and Pamela Morrison, and their 13-year-old daughter, Wendy. You know, Alan's a school teacher, Pamela's a social worker. It's set in 1990. So it's a time before the internet and email and the digital revolution and all that kind of thing. And, I do tell the story of what happened to them, a big part of the book also concentrates on, you know, how it affected them. How was the reaction of their family when they told them? And, I think that's a part of the research from people like myself, Martin, that has not been done down the years and has largely been ignored. So
Right, yes. I was 13 in 1990 and I went to the Star Observatory back then, and there was no digital age yet. There were computers but not internet. But it was very hard to get information, and I will tell you, there was a UFO research group, and as soon as I was at the Star Observatory, I discovered this UFO research group, being 13 years old, being attracted to it, and since then I've been with my head in it completely. But tell me about this family with this daughter of 13, because that's interesting.
Well, it is partly based on several close encounters here in the UK. One incident happened to what we call John and Sue Day and their daughters in the late 1970s in Averley in Essex.
Right.
And I met John once. I'd interviewed him some years ago. I'm one of only a handful of people ever to interview John. And so part of the encounter is based on John, and you know, he protected his children. You know, nobody spoke to them, so I had to kind of make go along with John's story and what have you. But also, there's a lady down in Lincolnshire called Rosalind Reynolds, and it's partly based on Rosalind's encounter. Not so much the visual things, but the way it actually affected her and the way she was treated and that kind of thing. And another lady called by the name of Jane, she played a big part in the story, because she when her encounters started, Martin, she turned to her family.
Right.
And like you do in many, you know, many instances, good and bad, and they didn't know what to do or how to help her. She would then ended up going to her doctors who prescribed, you know, pills, which was the last thing she needed, and eventually she found me quite by accident, and she was relieved to do so, and it was purely by accident that she found me. So it's an amalgamation of a number of encounters. So the fictional people, the Morrisons, you know, they're literally, you know, gone to visit family one evening, they're driving back home, and this again is a day before digital television, so he wanted to get back home to watch a particular TV program. Otherwise, if you missed it, you know, you missed it. It was finished.
Yeah. You could have a VCR, but
if you had a VCR, but he wanted to get home, and it's a game. I think you play it in Holland. It's snooker. That was the it's a big game here,
right?
And they have a peculiar encounter. And it's also, there's little hints of Betty and Barney Hill in it as well, because if you remember Betty and Barney Hill...
Oh, yeah, I know, yeah, they are very famous, Betty and Barney Hill, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they recollected some of what happened to them via these nightmares afterwards, and the same is with the fictional characters of the Morrisons. So there's a little touch of that in there as well. And so far, you know, it's been well received. The lady I mentioned who's an abductee called Rosalind... I let Rosalind read the manuscript beforehand and say, you know, is this accurate? I mean, you know, have I made any real big mistakes here? You know, have I got anything wrong? And she gave it the thumbs up. So, that, you know, if this came from someone who's had a close encounter, that was good enough for me. So I'm quite pleased with that. So, and, you know, the others have reviewed it as well and seem to find it... of some interest, Martin. I do point out in the beginning of the book that if you're looking for answers to the alien abduction phenomenon, then this is not the book for you. There's no answers there. It is a work of fiction, but for me, it puts the abductees in the correct frame, if you like. It shows them in the correct light, and points out that they're not, you know, lunatics and fruitcakes and that kind of thing. They're just ordinary people, and whatever the close encounter experience may or may not be, it can happen to anyone anywhere. And in this instance, the Morrisons in Once Upon a Missing Time, rightly or wrongly, it happened to them.
So, Philip, if I may put it correctly, the book Once Upon a Missing Time is more about the personal life of the abductees and of
it's the effect the close encounter has on them, Martin. I mean, I do graphically portray the encounter itself, but don't dwell on it too much. You know, we then look at, you know, to whom do they turn when this has happened? How do they deal with it? They're all already under pressure as a working family, you know, with a teenage daughter. Had two girls myself, so I can understand the pressures, you know. And who do they turn to, Martin? I mean, you know, you can't phone Ghostbusters. They don't exist.
No. And you can't go to your doctor because he will prescribe drugs for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also point out that then, and even now, maybe not as much now, but certainly then in the 1990s, there was still a huge stigma attached to the close encounter subject. If you went public, as some people did, not many, but some people did, you know, there was a stigma attached to it. It can affect you in all kinds of different ways. So, you know, I deal with that aspect of you know, what would happen or if and when you went public or if you choose not to. So, you know, we have to remember, you know, this is a different era. Certainly here in Britain in 1990, it was a time of change as well. Mrs. Thatcher had just left office, been replaced.
I do remember. In 1890, left, I think.
Yeah, yeah. She just
in 1991.
It was 1990, and you know, it was an era of change in Britain, and so it's all mixed in among that. I've set it in not a rural setting, Martin, but on, you know, semi-rural. It's based in the county where I live. Now, that just made it easier to write, Martin. I didn't have to think about other locations. I know where I live, and so it concentrates on how it affects, you know, the married couple. What happens when they tell their family, how they try to protect their daughter, and how they try and protect themselves, and how they try and deal with it. You know, you've interviewed people like this yourself, I'm sure, Martin, down the years, as have I, and you know, individuals deal with it in many different ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've used some of that, you know, after speaking to individuals and put that into Once Upon a Missing Time, and so far, it's you know, it seems to have worked, and we'll have to wait and see.
Yes, well, and I mean, I'm wondering how this family is still doing with the 13-year-old daughter. Do you still have contact with it? Because in 1990 there was snooker on TV. I'm now looking in your book, the Morrison family, right?
Yeah, well, they're fictional, but if you think about John and Sue Day, who I mentioned, who part of it is based on. They eventually, you know, separated, went their separate ways. John, when I met him, I actually met him in Suffolk many years ago and interviewed him. And he still, you know, remembers the encounter. He has strong opinions about it. And he worked with his hands. He made the most beautiful dolls' houses, you know, ornamental dolls' houses. John has moved around a bit since then, but he was still very protective of his daughters. When I interviewed him, they'd grown up, but there was no way anyone was going to speak to them. You know, he kept them, you know, out of the limelight, so to speak. And I remember seeing John Day once at a lecture in London, and he was very passionate about his encounter and, you know, spoke with great fervor about it. And, you know, it still puzzled him. He still had his thoughts and his own opinions of it, as all the abductees do as well, Martin. They don't all think the same thing. They all have their own different opinions about what's happened to them. So in the book itself, you know, it deals with how they, it looks at how they dealt with it and what happens to them eventually.
Yes, because in the era of the 90s, people were skeptical, and the whole opinion in society was much more ridiculized than it is today.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, as far as the media was concerned, and I think it's getting back to that, like that now, it was looked upon as what we call a silly season subject, you know, and the press dealt with it accordingly. It changed a little bit in the 1990s itself, Martin, because we had people like Dr. John Mack.
Yes,
become
yes,
involved. Here in the UK, we had Nick Pope at the MOD.
Yeah.
And that gave, for a good few years, the subject an air of credibility, if you like. Sadly, John's no longer with us, and Nick is still very active. He now lives in the United States. Mm-hmm. Very nice chap. Yep. But there was a TV documentary here on one of the main channels just a few months ago, and it had gone back to square one, Martin. You know, they just wanted to make fun for whatever reason. So I largely tend not to get myself involved with the media now. And so again, with Once Upon a Missing Time, I try to get rid of those stereotypes of what people think, you know, a close encounter witness is and what the encounter itself is, and try and use facts, try and show the personal and the human side of the story, because, you know, whatever your opinions on the close encounters, Martin, be it pro or skeptic, we're still dealing with human beings.
Well, my opinion is I'm very open-minded to it, because my platform is called ET First Contact Radio, meaning that everything that is related to extraterrestrials and UFOs is a topic to discuss on this station. And I can tell you, Philip, that my program and others like mine, there are many people now on the internet that have a radio show like Coast to Coast AM, and there are more and more programs now on the internet doing radio and video about ETs, aliens, abductions, but also you know, with channeled work from several people. And some people are skeptic to it, but I think it's a very good way to educate the public about what's happening above and inside the earth, because we are definitely not alone, Philip.
Well, I mean, again, you know, it's even if you're skeptical, Martin, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with a dose of skepticism.
No.
It's the debunkers that, you know, really, you know, get on my nerves. They say it cannot be, therefore it isn't, which is just, you know, is just nonsense. I mean, even from a skeptical point of view, these people still have an experience, you know, and even some of the well-known skeptics here will say it's this or it's that, but they're not denying that something has happened to these people. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing wrong in my mind with healthy skepticism. Skepticism just challenges what you're saying, challenges you to prove what you're talking about, and there's nothing wrong with that. You have to remember, Martin, you know, when we talk about aviation, for example, the Wright brothers were skeptics. Because conventional science said man cannot fly in a powered machine. And of course, they were skeptical of that and showed them that they could. So there's nothing wrong with a dose of skepticism. It's the you know, the Philip Classes of this world who just deny everything and debunk everything. Mm. Yeah. And that's, again, was one of the reasons for writing this book, is to show that, you know, you can have a wide variety of opinions on what close encounters may or may not be. You know, deny that they do happen. These people do have the most bizarre of experiences, and even the people themselves, and, you know, certainly the ones I've spoken to down the years, at times they're confused as to what is the nature and origin of these experiences, Martin, but they just say, this is what happened to me, Philip. This is what I can remember. This is what I saw. You know, you go figure it out, because I can't. You know? So, again, you know, that's all dealt with in Once Upon a Missing Time.
Yeah. How many people did you interview yourself, people that have had first-hand experiences?
Well, my very first book, you mentioned it in the introduction, is a book called Without Consent. Mm-hmm. With a friend of mine called Carl Nagatis. Now, Carl's not a UFO researcher. He runs his own public relations company. And when I met him, he was a journalist.
Right.
And again, this was in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, when there was no internet, there was no email. So there was only, you know, a limited amount of ways you could interview people. You could do it on the telephone, or you got in your car and you went to interview them. So what I did, you know, I was fit and healthy in those days. I got in my car and I went to interview them. And I can't remember how many I've spoken to down the years, Martin. It was certainly a lot.
Yeah.
And I literally went, you know, England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales, speaking to people face to face wherever I could. There were some people that we couldn't find, you know, we couldn't track them down, but yet we still had a file on them from somebody else. So we used one or two instances like that. But wherever possible, not just me, my colleague Carl did as well, but I did the majority of it, literally got in the car, you know, made an appointment, got in the car and interviewed them on tape.
Wow, very interesting. Because I must tell you, you had to be quite intelligent, very intelligent, in fact, in those days. For example, if you were looking for somebody who was living in a totally different area, you couldn't find up the address on the internet. You had to find a phone book from that particular area. Or you had to call the British Telecom Services to find out where they lived. And the research that you were doing was more complicated than it is today.
Absolutely, Martin. I mean, I used to, you know, I was director of investigations for the British UFO Research Association. Mm-hmm. And again, I think, you know, ufologists down the years in general have got, you know, some bad press. Because I'm not a scientist. I don't pretend to be. I don't have a PhD or a degree. But I think at times, Martin, they do a damn good job because they have no resources.
Yeah.
And, you know, certainly back in when I started, like you said, if we tried to find people, there was no internet. You wrote, you phoned, you know, and you'd follow leads. You had to be a sort of a master of a whole range of different specialities. You know, you had to be a detective to find these people. You had to be a counselor sometimes to deal with when you spoke to them, the emotional side of things. if you got a UFO photograph sent to you, you had to have a basic knowledge of photography. You had to know a bit of everything, to be perfectly honest.
Exactly, yeah. I must tell you, Philip, I have a deep respect for the early UFO researchers that started in the 80s and 90s, but also the 70s and 60s. But the early UFO researchers like yourself, they brought up all the knowledge for the big public today. Because now on Facebook, everybody that is in my contact list has some degree of knowledge about UFOs, because you get people that have friends in common, and you get to know Costa Macreas and Stephen Greer and all the people. But the early UFO researchers, they did groundwork that we are still deriving information from today. So
absolutely. I mean, and I relied on groundwork done by, you know, my predecessors in the early days, and great, you know, I always looked upon as my role as a UFO researcher, Martin, not to prove anything to anyone, but one of the ways I viewed my research was to record as much as I could,
yes,
be it in whatever format, and then preserve it for posterity, and hopefully in the future somebody, yeah, you know, much more intelligent than I could make sense of it. And you know, if you look back in any branch of science, that's what happened. You know, if you look in meteorology or you know, anything, they would record things.
Yes, they did.
And they had no idea what it was, but they thought, this is important, I'm going to make a record of this, I'm going to write this down, you know, and try and figure it out. And a lot of them failed, of course, but at some point in the future, all that material, all that information, all came to a point where somebody finally figured it out. So that's even today, I still look upon that as a very important role of any UFO researcher around the world, is to try and accurately document whatever comes their way.
Exactly, because documenting, and you know, the whole research work in ufology it's kind of, I'm driven to it, to interview people and to get the word out. That's my role as a radio host, but I know that many UFO researchers are kind of motivated, not only motivated, but also passionate about their work, and they want to go as deep as possible in their research.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's one of the things that keeps most researchers going down the years. There aren't that many here in the UK that have, you know, I sound like a really old man, Martin, but I'm not honest, but not many that have been going as long as I have. I mean, I started, you know, very late 1970s. I was very fortunate. I met Graham and Mark Birdsall, who formed what was the Yorkshire UFO Society. Graham, further down the line, of course, went on to publish UFO magazine, and he was the editor of it. Sadly, Graham's no longer with us. Mark has moved on. He's into other areas. So there are still some around that were around at the time. But, you know, and I think it's important to try and encourage the next generation, Martin. So, you know.
Indeed.
I'm about to edit a new magazine called UFO Today. That comes out in November. And that will be purely digital. But one of the things we're trying to do in it is to encourage new people, new involvement, younger people, and can take the subject on even further, hopefully.
I would love to read a copy of it, if you can send me one, if it comes out in November.
I will, Martin. You'll be on my list. Don't worry.
Yeah. Philip, what is your greatest fascination in the UFO field?
Well, I've always been interested in all things what I would label as paranormal, Martin. Mm-hmm. You know, going back as far as I can, I was always interested in anything that didn't fit into the norm, if you like.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the type of guy that if he sees a button and it says "don't press,"
I want to press it.
I want to press it and see what happens. You know, I'll give you an example. I used to be a technician in a factory, and I was being trained on a particular job. I won't bore you with the details. The gentleman who training it, he said, you know, after so many seconds, you do this. So I said, why so many seconds? And he said, Philip, he says, down the years, I have trained dozens of people to do this job. You're the only one that's ever asked me that question. You know, I wanted to know what happened if I, you know, didn't do it as he told me. So I always wanted to know. I was always interested in science and astronomy and, you know, I was born in an age when we had the race to the moon, I was 11 years old when the Apollo astronauts landed on the moon for the first time. I remember sitting and watching it at school. So, you know, I feel I'm quite fortunate in that respect. Mm-hmm. So when I came across ufology in the late 1970s, quite by chance, I wanted to find the answers, Martin, like many people do.
Yes.
What are UFOs? What lies behind it? Is there anything to UFOs? And I had a number of questions. They're just a few. Some of those have been answered, but yet there are others that are still yet to be answered, Martin.
I know.
So I'm still looking for the answers to those particular questions.
Yes.
And, you know, new questions arise that weren't there in the beginning as well. You find out certain information and you think, but what about this? So new questions arise all the time. And even after all this time, Martin, I'm still never ceased to be amazed about some of the information that comes our way. When you think you know it all, or you've heard it all, or you've seen it all, you know, something happens and you think, well, you know, that's got me beat. I don't have an answer for that. So, and it's that, you know, that aspect of it that keeps me going, keeps my interest.
It always does, and it keeps my interest as well. And it doesn't stop. It even gets more and more interesting.
Well, you know, I mean, my background, Martin, you know, my father worked down the coal mines all his life. So that was an area that I grew up in. I'll never forget an encounter, not alien abduction, but it was a landing account that happened in a small town called Normanton, quite near to where I live. And it's just a small town, you know, dotted with coal mines around the area. And a lady rang me and said, you know, you won't believe me. So I said, well, tell me. Anyway, she told me of the story, and I went to interview her in person. It was a lovely summer's day. Children were playing in the street. They were on holiday from school. They came running in. It was just after lunch. Said, Mom, there's something landed in the fields next to our house. So she came out. She could see across these fields, and she says, Philip, it was like a Mexican hat shaped, but it was grey in colour. So she grabbed the children. There were four or five children. They went towards this thing. They lost sight of it at one point, Martin, because there's a little dip. Came up the other side of the hill, and there was a fence around this field. So they stopped. Now was three tall men there, all dressed in white. And they seemed to be doing something. The children wanted to climb the fence, but she wouldn't let them. At this point, the three men slowly walked to the rear of this thing. It rose vertically, stopped in midair, and shot off without making a sound. And she never called it a UFO or a flying saucer or a spaceship or aliens. Her husband, who wasn't there at the time, because he was working down the mine. These were the kind of people I'd grown up with all my life, you know, and I could be as skeptical as I want, Martin, but I could not then and cannot now find any rational explanation for what this lady and her children saw. I even spoke to one of the children's friends. He didn't see it. He arrived about an hour later, but he told me how excited they all were, and they told him what they'd seen and so on. So they either saw something quite bizarre, or they were all lying.
I could find
no reason for them to lie at all, Martin. You know, again, she only found me because she saw a newspaper article I'd done in a local paper, quite by chance. And it's things like that that still leave me scratching my head. You know, it wasn't a helicopter. It wasn't an aeroplane. It wasn't the planet Venus or swamp gas or any other damn thing. You know, I have no idea.
It is a very fascinating subject. It is. And it keeps many people scrubbing their head. And it is fascinating. And Philip, I just want to play a little piece of music so that you can have a little break. I want to bring a cup of tea in the studio. And the song I'm going to play, as I promised you, is from Medwin Goodall. He lives in Cornwall in England. And he makes instrumental music with synthesizers, but also with acoustic instruments. And because a few minutes before the show, when we started, you said the word kindred spirits. And that's what we all are in the UFO field. We are kindred spirits. So this song I want to contribute to all the people in the UFO field who are doing hard work. And actually, I also want to play it as a kind of memory for Jesse Marcel, you know, the first...
I do, Martin. I met Jesse, and he was over here to lecture with us. I had the pleasure of spending a few days with him, and I showed him some of the beauty spots of our county here. Lovely, lovely man. Lovely man. And his honesty and his sincerity can never be doubted, and it was a very sad news to hear about his death.
Yes, and I saw him speak at the citizens' hearing on disclosure, and maybe it's a very good moment to remember his presence and the work he did. So for you, Philip, and for all the listeners, I'm going to contribute Gold Dust from the album Kindred Spirits from Edwin Goodall to Jesse Marcel and all other UFO researchers who are doing an amazing job. So we'll be back after the music.
Thank you.
Well, yes, Philip, very innocent music, and let's bless the innocent people with all their abduction stories and all the UFO researchers who did such wonderful work, and especially Jesse Marcel.
I would echo that, Martin. It's very good piece of music.
Yes. So now we are almost in the second hour. What do you want to discuss, Philip? Is there any important news or an important topic that you want to discuss with me?
There's always important news, Martin. I mean, I'm perhaps known in a lot of incidents for my work in the so-called alien autopsy film.
Yes.
Which I became involved with way back in 1993, and it was eventually shown on television around the world in August of 1995. And was in the thick of it right from the beginning, Martin, and took me many years of research. And again, you know, we talked about UFO researchers not getting any praise, if you like, not getting the credit they deserve. Well, I investigated the alien autopsy film for 14 years in total.
Wow.
And eventually I got to the bottom of it. It was a hoax. It was made for money. I mean, a lot of people speculated that it was a hoax, but couldn't prove anything, Martin. You know, you can speculate all you like. It's very easy to say, that's a fake, that's a hoax, but whatever. Proving it is something entirely different. So eventually, the man who led the team that faked it was called Spiros Malaris. And, you know, I've documented in my book, you mentioned it in the introduction, Roswell Alien Autopsy, the whole story of it, you know, how it all unfolded. But even now, you know, here we are in 2013, the interest is still there. There are some people that believe it's true. And literally, just a few weeks ago, Martin, five frames of film, actual celluloid, not digital, you know, dropped through my letterbox the old-fashioned way, in an envelope.
Yeah, yeah.
Claiming to be from the alien autopsy. I don't think it's authentic in that respect, but I'm still, you know, dealing with it now, still looking into it. I'm making inquiries. And believe it or not, I'm actually working on a film script with a lady called Elissa Simon in America. And it's based on my book, The Roswell Alien Autopsy, although, again, in large part, it is a work of fiction. Mm-hmm. So we're working on a film script about the alien autopsy film. You know, here I am, Martin, you know, if I think back to when I started in UFO research, I consider myself an ordinary man with an ordinary basic education from a very small, you know, mining village where I was born and raised. And if somebody said, when you're 55 years old, Philip, somebody would be writing a film script about you, I would have just laughed in their face, Martin. I really would. But again, you know, one of the reasons for writing this is to try and show the work that has to be done sometimes in UFO research. With the alien autopsy film, it wasn't the people like Philip Glass or the skeptics or anyone like that that got to the bottom of it. It was UFO researchers and me that finally found out the facts and the truth. Sadly, in this instance, it proved to be a huge money-making hoax. But there are other instances, like you mentioned before the musical interlude there, Martin. You mentioned Jesse Marcel Jr.
Yes.
You know, there's people who have devoted large parts of their life into investigating Roswell.
Yes.
And are still doing it now. You know, Kevin Randall, Don Schmidt, Stanton Friedman, Tom Carey. They're the main ones. Kevin Randall, by the way, he's a regular columnist in UFO Today, and his first column is written, and he's also done a tribute to Jesse Marcel in there. But they've dedicated their whole research life, in some parts, you know, to try and find the facts about a certain incident, but they don't get a lot of credit for it. And I think they should. You may not agree with their conclusions, Martin. That's fine. You know, that's the way of the world. But you cannot deny, you know, the work that they've done and they've tried to do. And again, you know, I think with topics like this, the UFO researcher doesn't get enough credit. And so, you know, again, if we go back to my fiction book, Once Upon a Missing Time, did write that quite some years ago, and I didn't really know what to do with it, Martin. It sat gathering dust for a while, and it was my wife that decided or persuaded me to get it published. But just a couple of years back, I began to work with a chap called Nabil Shaban. Nabil's an actor.
Yeah, I know him. Yeah,
you know Nabil, and writer in his own right. And Nabil and I have collaborated, and we have written a film script about alien abductions here in Britain based on Once Upon a Missing Time. We've just shortened it and we've just made it the title Missing Time. So, you know, we're actively looking for a production company as we speak. But again, one of the reasons for writing the film script is to try and highlight what happens to the individual. It's not all about the encounter itself. And we have expanded it a little bit from the book. But, you know, fingers crossed somebody somewhere will like it, and we may get the opportunity to paint the close encounter in the correct light, in the correct picture, in the correct frame, if you like. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, that would be really amazing if that would work.
Well, if you think back to the last, you know, alien abduction movie, it was Fire in the Sky, which told the story of Travis Walton. And I think most of the film is accurate. I've met Travis several times. But the abduction sequence that you see on screen is not accurate in any way, shape or form. And Travis has told me the reasons behind that, and I understand that. So for me, as far as UFO research is concerned, that was, a missed opportunity. It didn't factually represent, you know, what Travis encountered, what he remembered, what he saw. So if we ever get Missing Time made, which, you know, is a long shot, I've got to be honest, you know, hopefully we'll get the opportunity to show it in the correct light, much as my current work of fiction is trying to do. And then on top of that, I mentioned the magazine. It's simply called UFO Today. No agenda, no particular topic we're going to concentrate on, Martin. It is a potpourri of everything that is involved in UFO research. We have regular columnists, some of whom you'll know, like Kevin Randall, some of whom you've probably never heard of. But we're going to try and cover pretty much, as I dare say you do on your radio, Martin, anything and everything.
I've heard of Mr. Randall. I did.
Yeah, and you'll know Kevin, but there's some of the others in there that you won't have heard of. And we're going to try and cover as much material as we can, both old and new, Martin. You know, let's not forget the sort of UFO history. There are cases that we've looked at in the past, and new information crops up, so we'll deal with that. And I'm excited by it. I'm looking forward to the first issue coming out in November. It will be bi-monthly. It's only in digital format, so you'll be able to download it, you know, anywhere in the world. Don't have to worry about waiting for it arriving in the post. And you know, we're gonna deal with everything, if at all possible, anything and everything. So
yeah,
I'm looking forward to that.
Philip, by the way, I mentioned something. I met somebody, a gentleman, when I was in Glastonbury a month ago, and he is a film producer in England, and I might contact him and give his details to you. Maybe he wants to make a film with you.
Well, I think you're talking about Miles Johnson.
No, Miles Johnson is not that's another friend of me.
Okay.
He was twice on the show, but no, this is an another guy who is a film producer.
That's fine. Miles worked in television, of course, and I believe still does.
Yes. I don't know. I could connect you with Miles, but you're already connected to him, I suppose.
I know Miles. If the other chap, you, by all means, Martin. I mean, it's one of the good things about UFO research is they do, you know, tend to help each other out, you know, anywhere in the world. And if somebody's working on a particular project and you find somebody else's, I often find that, you know, people act as a kind of a conduit and connect to each other and say, oh, by the way, you should speak to him or her.
Yes, exactly.
They've got something you're looking for. And, you know, thank you very much, Martin.
Yeah, I have it here. 21st Century TV Wire. Patrick Henningsen, writer, presenter, director.
Well, you put him in touch with me, Martin, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I watch it on PSTV and Sky Channel 191. I think he might be interested in your movie script.
Thank you very much. I hope so. Fingers crossed.
Yes, I'm going to connect him with you.
Okay, great stuff. Thank you.
Yes. So yes, indeed, as you were saying, Philip, UFO researchers should get more credit. But I think the time will come, because as the political situation is unfolding right now, and the system that is collapsing, I think it's time for disclosure. And I have the feeling has been building up for the last couple of months that something major is going to happen. Also,
well, I don't know about that. What I will say, Martin, I think, you know, history will be kind to the majority of UFO researchers when people look back at, you know, at all kinds of recordings and books and magazines. I think, you know, history will treat us kindly, pretty much as we look back on, you know, early researchers in different branches of science now that were, you know, laughed at. And if we go back even further in time, you know, were imprisoned and killed for their
yeah,
scientific beliefs.
I know.
So I think ufology will also be looked upon in a very kind way in the years to come.
Indeed.
How many years, I don't know. But I think we'll be judged. History will judge us kindly.
Yes.
And you know, the answers that we all have been seeking, we'll believe we've found to be correct or not at some point in the future. Whether I'm still around remains to be seen. But I'm very positive about the future, and you know, literally with that, only time will tell.
Yes.
But you know, there's changes afoot in the world. None of us know what's around the corner, and all we can do is wait and see. But I remain optimistic, Martin, and very positive. But you know, you're a good bit younger than me. You probably see it. I may not.
Well, I'm 36 years old, and I'm also optimistic, and I've seen a lot of changes in the last decade or two. So, well, it would be great if the media would open up to the whole subject of ufology.
Well, the thing about the media, Martin, you have to remember that they're there to do a job, and that's it, you know. And their job mainly is to sell something, be it a magazine or a newspaper or a TV show. So it's all money involved, you know. It's not about telling the truth, although it pretends at times. You know, it is supposed to be the truth, but it's all about making a living and making money.
Right.
But you know, if you just look at ufology rather than, you know, the various political happenings around the world, I mean, you know, even in my time being involved, it has changed dramatically. You mentioned my colleague in the introduction, Paul Stonehill.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Paul's originally from the Soviet Union. He lives in America now. He's changed his name. He was originally Pavel, and he left the Soviet Union as a young man for, you know, many of the reasons that a lot of people tried to get out. Paul was even on the KGB wanted list at one point because he was trying to get other people out.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, I met Paul in the late 1980s. We've collaborated on various things. The last book we did was, you know, Russia's Roswell incident. It's about the Dalnogorsk crash in Height 611 in Russia. And, you know, we've seen a lot of changes there because there was the collapse of the Soviet Empire, of course. And then with the advent of that and the internet, you know, access to information in the what was the former Soviet Union became available. We learned that the KGB, for example, conducted the biggest ever official UFO study anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And because when it was happening, no one knew about it outside of Russia. You know, there was a time in the Soviet Union when UFOs was a banned subject and you could go to the gulag, you know, for being involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
So again, some of the UFO researchers there at the time, you know, risked their liberty to be involved in ufology, Martin. It's not something we've ever faced here in the West. You know, we may have risked a bit of credibility at times, but they actually, you know, risked their liberty. They could have gone to prison. And again, you know, I don't think they've got the credit that they deserve. But Paul and I are still working on things from, you know, the former Soviet Union and other places around the world. We have a new book in the pipeline now, but that's about UFOs underwater, you know, USOs. And that's another, you know, branch of ufology that I think's largely gone ignored. So we're working on that now. That'll be out, you know, within a few months. And, you know, we're fortunate with Paul because he can speak the language and he can read and write it. You know, I had tons of material alive from the Soviet Union, Martin, but of course, until I met Paul, I couldn't understand a word of it. You know, I struggled to read English at times, never mind Russian. So I literally packed all this in a box eventually, a huge box, and sent it to Paul, and he was astonished by it, you know, absolutely astonished. And fortunately, he could read it. So, you know, the language barrier was a problem at time, but again, today, that's not as big a problem as it was. Certainly with you know, translation facilities online and things like that, you can make things out. So the internet has been a great boost in some respects for ufology, but you know, it's not been that brilliant in other areas as well. You've seen a demise in the actual formation of UFO groups. You know, when I left the British UFO Research Association, it had 1,000 members, successful conferences, you know, and were involved in pretty much everything. And sadly, that's pretty much all gone. They're still going, but there's only a handful of people left. I think the internet played a big part in that, Martin, you know, but so there's good and bad in it. But, you know, I remain optimistic.
All right, this was ET First Contact Radio for September the 5th, 2013. I'll be back next Sunday and Monday on Finding Voices, and next week I'll have another guest on BBS Radio. Thank you for listening. Namaste.